So our Old Testament scripture, which we just heard, has us continuing this journey with Moses and the people. Life continues on under stressful conditions. In chapter 20, the chapter right before the one we're considering today, Miriam dies and is buried. There's a shortage of water. The people rail against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Why have you brought us into this wretched place? Moses is able to provide water. The journey continues. They're unable to journey through Edom because of a long hostility between the Edomites and the Israelites. So they make plans to go around. The journey is longer and perhaps harder because of this. Aaron dies. The people mourn Aaron for 30 days. The journey continues and the people grumble. And then there are the snakes. You might recall, those of you who were around in the 80s, the first Indiana Jones movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark. In one of the scenes that I remember quite vividly, and then I looked it up and was like, yeah, that's it. Our hero, Indiana Jones, is staring down into what is called the Well of Souls in the movie. And the floor is just littered, undulating with snakes. So he peers down into this, and then he flips over on his back in sheer exasperation. Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes? The one thing he fears is in front of him, and he has to deal with it. And it is a common fear. On a list of things that people fear the most, we heard them this morning, but snakes is one of them. Heights, spiders, common fears that we have. And that one with snakes comes up again and again throughout Scripture. And we humans, depending upon our culture and our era and our own experience, do have relationships with snakes that are not only about fear. So you might be familiar with the medical symbols that depict, almost very close to what the children saw a few minutes ago, snakes intertwined on a staff. Ancient Greeks and other people thought that snake venom was remedial, and actually there is current research on snake venom as an agent, as a treatment in some cancers. Many people see the shedding of snakes as a symbol of rebirth, renewal, regeneration. And indeed, as we heard, Moses holds up an image of a serpent as a means of healing. In the midst of these grumbling people, and I think that sometimes we read the story of the Israelites and their constant grumbling and get a little bit annoyed with them, but I mean, it was stressful, right? It was a long, stressful journey. Why have you brought us here to die? The people ask. Look at the snake and live, Moses says. Here we have Moses and God, through Moses, telling these weary, downtrodden people who would gladly go back to their oppressors to get out of this mess if only Moses would let them. And they get this message, the thing that you think will destroy you, the thing that is indeed destroying you, may be the thing that helps you live. Facing the thing you think will destroy you can be used to help you survive. This week, I was reminded of one of the lesser known heroes of the civil rights movement, and you may have heard the story on NPR or seen it on social media, Georgia Gilmore. The headline of the story on NPR's webpage read, "Meet the Fearless Cook, who secretly fed and funded the civil rights movement." Now, on consideration of that headline, I was like, fearless? I don't know. Sometimes I think that what she did, and I'll say a little bit about that in a moment, but maybe there were some fears there, certainly reason to be. Ms. Gilmore was a cook, was a midwife, was an activist, who cooked and sold food, fried chicken, pound cake, sweet potato pie, more, to help pay for alternative transportation for the people who were boycotting the bus in Montgomery after Rosa Parks, a more well-known name, refused to give up her seat to a white man, which she was obligated to do under the custom of segregation at that time. For 381 days, the people of Montgomery boycotted the bus. Yet they still had to get to work. They still had to get to school. They had to do life, but they were committed to boycotting the segregated bus system until it changed. And Ms. Gilmore and others supported that movement. We know the more famous names of that movement, Rosa Parks certainly, Martin Luther King Jr. certainly, but many, many, many people had to support the effort of not riding the bus in an era where most people didn't have two cars or even one car for over a year. I think of people like Georgia Gilmore, like Rosa Parks, like Emma Gonzalez, the Stoneman Douglas High School survivor and gun control activist, as those who are showing us, those among the many who show us what it is to look into the face of that which may destroy you and live. I hear in these stories that it is possible, not easy, but possible to look up at what you fear the most. And in our text, and in the few examples that I've shared today, and maybe others that you might be thinking of from your own experience, I think it's important to note that these people that I've named did not do this alone. They operated within the context of community. A wide, broad community full of people to help pull them along, to shore them up on those days when they probably thought, not this again. I don't know if I can do this one more day. Moses is pulled into his leadership role by God. The people are on their journey, are sharing the burdens of staying alive in the midst of remaining a people called out by God. Georgia Gilmore, Rosa Parks, Emma Gonzalez, and so many more did and do their work in solidarity and in community with others who are walking with them. I know for myself that the journeying with makes so many things much more possible. In the New Testament scripture, John's Gospel, Jesus, we hear these words in the midst of Jesus being engaged with a conversation with Nicodemus about second births, about the distinction between earthly things and heavenly things, about the Son of Man being lifted up just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness. "Trust in that, and you will live," Jesus says. There is something that happened there, Nicodemus, that I can't explain to you in a way that is about reason. And perhaps we have only framed this text, and particularly verse 16, John 3:16, into its most narrow explanation, which I don't think is the most helpful way to think about it, nor completely accurate when it's framed in the context of a highly individualistic, self-made person context that we live in now. The gospel verse, in its wider context, is an assertion of God's love for the world and the extent of that love's manifestation. Jesus' response, I believe, to Nicodemus' question is not just a pithy one-liner on how to seal the deal on eternal bliss. Rather, it is an expression of the fullness and wideness of the love of God that holds the world together in the midst of feeling when it feels as though everything is falling apart. It is an assertion that has been in the works from the foundation of creation, echoing the distinctive way that John opens his gospel, not with a birth narrative of Jesus like the other three gospels, but with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We are reminded again in that assertion in the beginning of John's gospel of the creation narrative in Genesis, when the Creator speaks the world into existence, the Word, and proclaims it good. From the beginning, the Creator has loved the world and has invited us to love it as well, to see ourselves as connected to creation, to God the Creator, and to each other. To know that when we are afraid, when we are wounded, when we are simply falling apart, we are not alone. For God has loved us into being, and God will love us through our fears. God will love us through our failures, and God will love us through what has failed us. That, beloved, is good news, not because it assures us of some celestial prize at the end of our earthly days, but because remembering and living into this vision of God's equips us in small ways and large to be co-creators of health and safety and justice, to be regenerators of hope with each other and with God. May it be so.